recovery buses amid rising temperature and a new wave of coronavirus infections.
An aquarium in the French capital, Paris, is celebrating the birth of a baby black-tip shark. The female shark is 55 centimeters long and weighs 560 grams. She's currently quarantined in a small pond so she wouldn't come under attack by adult sharks. Officials at the aquarium say she'll be ready to swim amongst other sharks in 3 to 4 months. She was born last week at the aquarium, an event the caretakers say is very rare.
It's a rare event for us, which hadn't happened here for the past 5 years. The birth is quite rare in aquariums and in captivity in general. In fact, there are often embryos that won't survive, or they're sometimes stillborn. That's what makes it a rare event, which also occurs at night. We had the chance to observe it during the day, which allowed us to intervene very quickly, and we're able to recover the little one.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature has designated black-tip sharks as a vulnerable species. It's particularly poached in some countries for their distinctive fins. The marvelous creatures have a torpedo-shaped body and often spin out of water while eating. They have specialized cells in their snouts that detect the electric current of nearby prey.
A Turkish farmer hails the miraculous survival of 2 baby goats from deadly wildfires. Sergeant Bayat said seeing his livestock threatened by flames was the most difficult moment in his life. Bayat said although he lost 8 of his animals in the fire, he found new life after the survival of a newborn goat. He said the mother of the kid had been killed in a wildfire. Bayat called it a miracle. But there was also another baby goat.
We found another goat amidst a wildfire. She has a baby. There you go. Miracle number 2.
Bayat says although his farm was severely damaged, he's now over the moon at the survival of the baby goats. A massive forest fire in southern Turkey broke out on Wednesday, fueled by strong winds. Wildfires are common in southern Turkey in the summer, but local authorities say the latest fires have covered a much bigger area.
Cats are notoriously volatile animals, as we all know. One moment they are purring for your attention, and the next they can't stand being touched. Now, a Canadian firm has come up with an app that can help you better understand your feline friends. The app is called Tabli and works with artificial intelligence. The AI's algorithm was trained at a clinic in the city of Calgary. The developers of Tabli hope their product can be useful for novice cat owners and vets alike. The app can also help monitor the health of cats. Tabli's developer explains how the app functions.
It uses artificial intelligence, so specifically machine learning, and it's coupled with the feline grimace scale. And what the feline grimace scale is, it's a way for humans to be able to determine if a cat is in pain or not based on the ear positioning, the eye positioning, the muzzle, whiskers, things like that. And so we were able to train a machine using machine learning and a series of images to be able to make that determination. So if you're somebody who has a cat but you don't have that training, you can just use the app and it can help you determine this how your cat is doing.
Sounds very useful, but Tabli is not perfect though and runs into problems when trying to decipher the mood of black cats. Despite the hiccups, the developers say the program will get better at doing its task as its artificial intelligence develops through practice. Humans have damaged the environment, perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Known in Cyprus as Birdman, 28-year-old Konstantinos Antonio is a wildlife veterinarian. Every year, he saves hundreds of sick or wounded wild birds. The animals brought to him are usually found by regular people. Konstantinos says climate change has made the task of assisting birds more urgent as their survival becomes harder and harder. The Cypriot environmentalist usually frees the animals after treatment in the presence of other people in order to raise awareness about the issue. Vertical forest has transformed the Chinese megacity of Chengdu into a concrete jungle, making the lives of the residents greener. Each unit at the 8-tower complex has a balcony with around 20 types of luxuriant plants and greenery. The green space filters air and noise pollution while creating a spectacular view. The project in the southwestern city was completed in 2018, and all of the 826 apartments were sold out at the time.
I think it's quite good. The air quality is pretty good and much better than my old houses. The air is good when you wake up in the morning, and the green trees are good for us elderly people. They are good for our eyes.
Besides all the benefits, the apartments have a major problem. They have been overrun by plants and invaded by mosquitoes. The issue has forced some of the occupants to move out. Other cities around the world, such as New York and Copenhagen, have also launched similar green housing projects.
The best visited multimedia exhibit in the world, known as Van Gogh Live, the experience has opened in Munich after being postponed a number of times due to COVID-19.
Van Gogh is just the most famous artist in the world. He is also a prototype artist. He is the last artist who then tragically dies at the end. His life story was just fascinating, and that's why he is Van Gogh. But of course, his artworks are fascinating.
Featuring some of Van Gogh's best-known works, the exhibition is not only a feast for the eyes, but the senses, with music and smells to accompany the colorful projections. The exhibit is supposed to smell like the countryside because of where Van Gogh lived. However, the organizers say visitors cannot really experience the feeling due to wearing masks. Van Gogh Alive, the experience, was first presented in Singapore in 2011. Since then, the multimedia exhibit has been seen in 70 cities and has attracted some 6 million visitors.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight. Parts of the United Kingdom have again faced rain and localized flooding, but forecasters have said a drier and sunnier summer could be possible by the end of the month. The article you're about to hear has been written by the London Evening Standard journalist Elmira Tanatarova. The piece is titled Areas Hit by Flooding as Torrential Rain Sweeps Across Parts of UK. Parts of the UK have again faced rain and localized flooding, but forecasters have said a drier and sunnier summer could be possible by the end of the month. The dismal summer weather continued on Saturday, 7th of August, with parts of London and Glasgow flooded due to heavy rain, and the Met Office warning that torrential rain will continue to affect the southeast of England throughout the day. There are also warnings of heavy rain, thunderstorms, flooding, lightning strikes, cold winds and hail in central and southern Scotland, in northern England and Northern Ireland for this weekend. There is hope that summer may not be over, with drier conditions forecast for later in the month. Videos and photographs of heavy flooding on the roads and drains full of water were posted on social media by people in Walthamstow in northeast London and Battersea in south London, and two London Underground stations, Stepney Green and Holborn, closed due to the flooding, as well as a platform at Liverpool Street station. There was also flooding in Drumchapel, Glasgow, with one video posted on Twitter showing a car abandoned by its owners under a railway bridge. However, it is likely the weather will clear up for a chance at a drier summer towards the end of August. Met Office meteorologist Becky Mitchell told the Press Association news agency it's going to stay quite changeable at least for the next week, but as we head towards the end of August, there's likelihood we'll see hotter spell of weather and drier, more settled weather across the whole of the United Kingdom. While it is too early to predict temperatures at this stage, it could potentially be in the high 20s. Meteorologist Becky Mitchell said that even though it may not seem like it, this summer has been warmer and drier than average. She said, it's not been wetter on average, but we've seen a lot of reports on the news about flooding. That's why it may feel like a bad summer with not much warmth or sunshine. She explained that the only exception has been the southeast of England, which has been wetter than usual and has already had 111% of its average rainfall for the summer. Becky Mitchell added, the cause of the torrential rain and thunderstorms is down to the fact that July was so hot. She said, we've had quite a lot of warm weather and there was a heat wave during the middle part of July. The end of that heat wave triggered a lot of thunderstorms and heavy and intense rain, which is what brought some of those flooding incidents across parts of the southeast of England. There has been a lot of rainfall in a short amount of time, creating localized flooding events rather than it being a wet period. The worst hit places appear to be the City of London, which has had 143% of its average rainfall this summer, the Isle of Wight, with 174% of its average summer rainfall, and Surrey, with 126% of its average rainfall. Becky Mitchell believes the Isle of Wight will only get rainier and imagines the percentage will be much higher by the end of the summer. By comparison, Scotland has only had 38% of its average rainfall, and Becky Mitchell says a few northern areas have been much, much drier.
Dark Review.
and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Let It Fall, LA 1982 to 1992, directed by John Ridley. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Suresh Grover, who is the director of the Monitoring Group, which is a leading anti-racist charity here in the UK that promotes civil rights. Now, Let It Fall provides an in-depth look at the racial tensions in Los Angeles in the 10 years leading up to the 92 riots, which erupted after the acquittal of four police officers charged in the brutal beating of Rodney King. The riots caused a lot of destruction in the streets of LA, which resulted in the death of more than 50 people, who were mostly black, injured over 2,000, and caused at least $1 billion worth of damages.
The Los Angeles police officially reprimanded police chief Daryl Gates.
We were having deaths from the chokehold.
He didn't get along with the community.
In the early 80s, the street gangs started to connect with the drug dealers.
It just got out of control.
Karen Tashima was killed in gang crossfire.
This is something that you always see on the news, and this time it happened to us.
We are determined to take back the streets of Los Angeles.
Operation Hammer was a free ticket to go out there and do overly aggressive police work.
What I witnessed at the scene was 100% LAPD policy.
Soon Ja Do, found guilty of killing a 16-year-old girl, received no jail time.
She got away with murder.
Black and brown people are being beat up, shot, choked to death by police forces all over this country.
We, the jury, find the defendant not guilty.
You just disrespect us like this? Like our lives don't matter?
Not guilty, the verdict for all of them.
We were sort of stunned.
We need to back out of here before we have to use deadly force.
It's like pouring gasoline and striking a match. It's not protesting anymore. Now it's a full-blown riot.
I was a part of a movement, a black movement. There's a Florence and Normandy in every city and every state.
It was just one of those days compassion wasn't handed out to other races.
God told me to go save them, save that man's life.
You talked about guerrilla warfare, and it's right here.
18-year-old Edward Song Lee was shot to death.
It doesn't seem real. I felt like it couldn't be happening to us.
I know the anger, and I know exactly what my people are feeling.
We've lost the city. It's gone.
I want to know why God let this happen.
Unity, empowerment, they're not just cliches. We have to get ourselves together.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. Very much welcome here. And when you watch this documentary, you feel an overwhelming sense of injustice against black people in the US. And another thing that's striking about this documentary is that it's an oral history as told through many different perspectives and angles, through police officers, jurors, and a whole host of others, the victims and families of the victims. And Lee, if I can start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
I think you've sort of identified what makes it unique and what makes it particularly probing is it's an inside story. So the filmmakers, they don't go to pundits and people from the outside. Every single person you hear from was within the story. They're part of the story, whether they're perpetrators or victims or police or, you know, lost loved ones. And that and keeping to that very tight focus, I think, really, I mean, it obviously ups the emotional side of the stories because people are talking about their direct personal involvement, but it gives you that unique perspective because we're not trying to hear from, you know, professors and cultural critics outside it. We stay very much within the story, and I think that's a really great move. The other thing that's great is he doesn't identify who's who. So you start hearing from people, you might then find that they were a policeman who was, you know, inflicted some violence, or, you know, an African American who was involved in, you know, hurting a white American. And by doing that and saving the sort of the revelation, you get to just hear who these people are before. Otherwise, you might just immediately identify them as, oh, racist police officer, mm-hmm. or, you know, violent African American. And of course, what you're hearing is a more sort of multifaceted side to each of these stories. And I think that's a real strength in the film.
That is indeed a great strength, and you hear their personal stories, and I enjoyed that progression, and you feel a connection to all these characters. And Suresh, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Let It Fall?
I think it's a rich history, almost a forensic examination of a decade before the so-called uprisings. I wouldn't call it, I use the word uprising, and there's a reason for it. And I think it tries to focus on what took place, what incidents took place which led to the build-up of the riots, which is very important. The context is very, very important. And even in this country, when there are public disturbances taking place, people only look at one trigger moment that started the stuff, rather than the history of relationship between the black communities and the police, for example.
So you're saying this context, this build-up is very important.
The context is absolutely critical. I mean, you know, the police commissioner's views about baton charges, metal baton charges, choke holes, and he tries to describe black people not suffering as much as the white people in terms of that. It's just sheer racism, in my view. It unmasks the real relationship between the authorities and people who live in the area, who took part in it and who survived in it.
Of course, LA was a very iconic city, it still is, but particularly at that time because of the Olympics, and they even had their first black mayor. So who would know underneath the surface that all this racial tensions was bubbling?
Well, I think what he's trying to point out is that it's enmasked it, but actually people who live in it know exactly what's happening, including the police office and the mayor and the police commissioner. So although the story in cinematic terms is being told through different eyes, what is clear is that the bubble and the bubbling and the simmering and of dissent and the relationship souring between different authorities is actually very, very open and pertinent, and people are turning a blind eye to it. For example, you know, the chokehold is being criticized by everyone. It's actually made illegal. So what do the police do? Instead of decreasing their powers, they increase their powers by using a metal baton. And they use both taser and, I mean, youth.
And I'll have to pause you there. We'll go into that a bit more detail later on.
One of the many issues that came up during his time as a chief was the chokehold. It was a controversy for a long, long time in the media.
The Los Angeles Police Commission late today officially reprimanded Police Chief Darrell Gates for comments he made last month about black people and a police restraint method.
Chief Gates said, in some blacks, when it is applied, the veins or arteries do not open up as fast as they do in normal people.
That's asinine. That's insanity. That I still to this day can't believe someone said that. And, of course, that raised a firestorm.
There is a direct parallel between the disproportionate killing of black people in this city and the irresponsible remarks of the chief of police.
That was truly shocking comments made by the LAPD police chief at the time, Darrell Gates. And of course, we learn a bit later on in the documentary that he refused to apologize for those comments, and he gave a sort of apology for people being offended, which is hardly an apology. Lee, what was your reaction watching those comments being made?
Well, I mean, they're horrific, and Darrell Gates. I mean, this area and this time in American history and leading up to the riots, there's been a number of films made on this in the last few years, and so the film goes over. You know, if you're familiar with those films, a lot of familiar ground. So Darrell Gates has been vilified, very rightly so, a lot of the time. What's very interesting about this film is there's a section towards the end where they show that his son himself was addicted to drugs. And it's not letting him off the hook in any shape or form, but it's giving you another side to this person who is very easy otherwise to just demonize as, you know, the big bad guy. And don't get me wrong, his policies and his, you know, his stance is you know, you can't justify it in any way. But what's really interesting about the film is it tries to sort of look at people from different angles and maybe give facets of them you didn't know about without excusing it. But, you know, you go, okay, well, then this guy has some other issues going on at the time. Now, again,
it's a very complex story.
It's really trying to look at things from a wider angle than you maybe have seen in the past.
And, Suresh, would you agree with what Lee said just there? What did you make of these comments being made?
Life is complicated. People are very complicated. I've been in riots in Southall in the 70s, and I know people are complicated. But to justify, I'm not saying Lee is justifying it, I don't want to give an air of justification. To me, the comment about the chokehold and not apologizing was sheer racism, and there's no excuse for it. He's a senior police officer. He's a senior police officer who should be held accountable for his comments and his practices and procedures. Mm-hmm. Yes, he's a human being, but we are beyond that in that environment. So when I live in areas like Southam, which is where I come from, which is Hadriat, right, I expect police officers to be totally professional. What I don't expect them to do is to blame the victim or the communities that are victimized by police officers because of their racism. And it's happened not just to black people, too. I mean, I did a case of Blair Peach, who was killed by the SPG in 1979. You know what the police said? He had a thin cranium, that's why he died. And they used a lead gauge baton to kill him in 1979. In Mark Duggan's case, what did they say? Honest but mistaken belief. So there's a justification that takes place perpetually by the mainstream and politicians. I do not want to excuse that.
Yes.
That doesn't mean, cinematically, people can't look at the complicated picture and come to a resolution. But our society is divided between people who have power and who don't have power.
That's
really important to look at.
And Lee, I want to ask you, in picking up on your point, do you think Ridley was sympathetic in any way to the riots through this film? Do you get the idea that the police are in fact the problem, that the riots or uprisings didn't happen out of a vacuum, that people just became crazy one day?
No, I mean, the whole 10-year time frame, as Suresh has noted, it gives you the context and it gives you a lot of understanding of why tensions within the communities and between the police and not just the African American community, the Korean American community, Japanese American, it's a very, you know, diverse picture that this film paints. I think Ridley is very, he's an interesting figure because he's kind of known as a bit of a polemicist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wrote a very controversial piece for a magazine about 10 years ago using the N-word and criticizing his own community. Mm-hmm. You know, with 12 Years a Slave, which he wrote
the
screenplay
for.
Yeah, him and the director had a big falling out. And I was surprised, actually, at how much empathy this shows. It's not his usual sort of, you know, mode of speaking, if you like. He's very much into controversy, usually, and stirring things up. And I felt that this was a much more restrained and, you know, trying to be more empathetic. Look at it. He doesn't let anybody off the hook. So, as I said, you don't identify some of the people speaking, and then you find that actually some of these guys were the guys who dragged the white truck driver out of the van and you know, nearly killed him.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly with the police, you see some people making some very, you know, reasonable statements, and you find out they're absolutely part of the endemic racism of the LA police force. So I was very interested at getting that sort of, you know, empathetic thing, and again, without letting anybody off the hook, and, you know, there is clear racism going on there without any shadow of it.
Well, of course, and it's interesting that so many interpretations can come out of this, and I guess that's a testament to the documentary. And Lee, as we heard in the documentary, one of the police officers in charge at the time told his police officers to avoid that area. Were they effectively then abandoning their duty to protect and serve?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm certainly no expert on police tactics and what you should and shouldn't do, but there was a very clear, you know, decision taken to pull out, and obviously that creates a vacuum, and that allows a lot more things potentially to go on that maybe would be restricted if there was a police presence there. But I mean, this is just part of the chaos. I mean, what it does, it really gives you a picture of the absolute chaos that happened within those 2 days. I was actually in LA probably a couple of weeks after these events, and I was actually walking around through South Central LA. I'd never been in a sort of supposedly peaceful community that had such an air of foreboding and tension. And so it was still, you know, just absolutely in the air, really, really unnerving. So I can only imagine what it would have been like on the 2 days in question. Again, that's no excuse not to get the police in there, because that effectively is their job, to try and maintain, you know, some sort of, you know, so that things don't just descend into utter chaos. But yeah, it obviously had a huge impact on the events of those 2 days.
And Suresh, why didn't the police go to the area? Were you surprised by their reaction? Were they intimidated by the riots?
I wasn't surprised at all by the reaction. It's a very common police practice in a public disturbance to leave an area on its own. You know, public disturbances and riots raise a number of issues. And one of them is, why is it that law-abiding citizens living in that area destroy their town?
But they have genuine grievances.
I've been involved, as I said, I've participated in public disturbances. The trigger for me has been racists coming in and the police not stopping them, and then the police arresting us on a continuous basis. And
so the victims,
there's
instead
a time
of the
bomb
perpetrators.
That comes. And when you are there, you realize the danger that exists. You realize the chaos that exists. You realize that you live in the area and you're breaking up a shop and that you're fighting with the police. You actually realize it's very conscious. It's not as if it's unconscious and there's got nobody's in control. It's frightening. And it's only people who participate in it, who want to create a message, actually win the day. So you create those areas where the police can't enter for a specific period, for a specific reason. And that is to say that if we are not heard, and if after all, even according to, you know, the apostle of peace, Martin Luther King, riots are the voices of the unheard, mm-hmm. which is actually what they are. Yes, you have sterile areas created by the police. In the same way, you have policing of what you call saturation policing, which they talk about in the earlier period, which is indiscriminate arrests at certain times to create fear in community.
It was Project Hammer, I think, they called it in the documentary, Operation Project Hammer.
Yeah, I mean, in this country, they call it saturation policing. Mm. And we've, in BRICS.
Well, we'll just pause there for now. John Ridley talking during an ABC radio interview with Amna Nawaz about the prospect of another uprising.
Worry there could be similar kinds of level of riots or uprisings and
absolutely
you think that,
you know, look, whether how the scope and scale, how big they are, how pervasive they are, you know, again, you know, Los Angeles is a city, how it was policed, and I don't even mean the psychology of it, just the numbers, the demographics, what the capacities were, it's very, very different. It was very, very singular. So I have no doubt in terms of interactions, in terms of what happens in communities, how we look at each other, you know, that we know, I mean, we just know that there are issues, whether that results in a large-scale uprising, whether it results in a few individuals spilling out on the streets, mm-hmm. whether that is a public demonstration where police and citizenry are going out together to say, look, there's an issue and we got to deal with it, or whether it's just people who feel like they're fed up, you know, how it happens, what the results are, that I can't predict, but I'm absolutely sure that there are stress points, that there are people who feel like they're being marginalized, they're not being listened to somewhere right now, and they are going to want recourse. We need to make sure that that recourse is positive, it's real engagement, because otherwise, you know, when you take away people's voices, when you take away their ability to be heard, they will make themselves heard in any way that they feel is appropriate.
Lee, you were just saying earlier how much of an activist Ridley is. What did you make of his comments there in that radio interview?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important. You know, historically, he's done these, you know, he's had these moments where people have been very critical of what he's done. People change. And I think he would probably say that he's not the same filmmaker or maybe even person that he was when he did these other projects. And fair play to him. You know, if we're discussing this particular film, I think it's a really balanced, restrained, empathetic portrait that really tries to get to the, you know, the hub of a wide range of issues. So, you know, I can only kind of agree with everything he's saying. And it's also, I think the other thing is, we hear so much about this one time in LA. I would love to hear similar projects about other cities in the US and also in other countries. It's not just America that has systemic, you know, issues with its police force and racism and stuff. It's happening all over the world. And it would be great if there were, you know, similar projects as detailed and nuanced that covered other areas. I know more about, you know, Rodney King and Natasha Harlins than I do about some of the, you know, the issues that have happened in this country simply because of the proliferation of documentaries and studies about this time. Mm-hmm. It's all important, mm-hmm. but I'd also like to see other areas and other countries covered in a similar way.
That's interesting. Of course, this year marks 25 years since the LA riots. Perhaps this is why the emergence of these documentaries are coming out. But Suresh, I'd like to ask you, actually, what are some of the differences or similarities between the US and the UK when it comes to institutional police racism and how they treat black people?
Let's look at the similarities. I think the British police has been found to be institutional racism because of the McPherson inquiry in 1999. And there hasn't been enough work done by the police to show that they haven't, they've actually dealt with it properly. You've seen in this country, just like America, although the proportion of killings in America is much, much, much greater, you have something like 16 deaths a day. Mm-hmm. You don't have the same frequency, but it's a smaller black population than America. The American population has been there longer. I think what you really have in similarity is the lack of accountability of the police force. The manner in which police always, almost get away with murder or police brutality. Nobody's actually held account in a public arena.
Of course, this is why what caused the riots, effectively the straw that broke the camel's back, was that there was videotape evidence of Rodney King's brutal beating,
I think
the police officers walked free.
Yeah, they walked free in Bradley Cave's case as far as the district was concerned. But obviously, as you know, two people were convicted in the federal court, the subsequent trial. And there are important points to make on the judiciary as well in this trial.
The whole criminal justice
system.
The
differences are that just the black American political process of being there for a long time, of developing resistance or black power politics is much more deep-seated than in this country. But this country has this glass ceiling which does not see pivotal figures in the black community just as important as the black, as the Americans would do in terms of black. For example, people like Hugh Newton in the black power movement. There are equivalents in this country. And just like this film, there's a film called Hard Stop on Tottenham Riots, mm-hmm. which is a fascinating, moving film of the killing of Duggan told through the eyes of his two friends. It's a fascinating film. It could be much better if it was given more finances. Mm-hmm. So there are attempts to be made. But I think this country neglects and actually does not acknowledge the skills that black communities have in their communities, young people, women, and children.
So there's much work to be done, I suppose. And unfortunately, we're reaching the end of the program now. And Lee, just the final 30 seconds to you. Would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I think, I mean, I've seen quite a number of the recent films that either touch on this specific area or, you know, institutional racism. And I would say it's one of the more thorough and nuanced films. I would also recommend the Made in America film, which, mm-hmm. again, covers similar things. But it really is, when people actually, it's proper journalism. And it's also good filmmaking. And when you put those together, you know, you really do allow viewers to get a better understanding. And then hopefully that's what you can build on to sort of, you know, change things in the future.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for coming on to Doc Review. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this episode. And that's it. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
An months after fleeing the state to thwart passage of restrictive voting laws, Texas Democrats again refused to appear at the state capitol. We now present you an article written by staff writers of the Associated Press news agency. The piece is titled, Texas Democrats Still Absent as U.S. Republicans Make Third Bid to Pass Vote Laws. The article has been taken from the Associated Press. Please stay with us for more. Texas Democrats have refused to return to the state capitol as Governor Greg Abbott began a third attempt at passing new election laws, prolonging a months-long standoff that ramped up in July when dozens of Democratic state lawmakers left the state and hunkered down in Washington, D.C. Republican House Speaker Dade Phelan, who then adjourned the chamber until coming days, said a quorum is not present. More than 50 Democrats recently bolted to the nation's capital, but the precise whereabouts of each of them is unclear. In a joint statement on Saturday, 7th of August, Democrats said 26 of them would remain part of an active presence in Washington, maintained for as long as Congress is working. But there were also signs the stalemate may be thawing. Two of the Democrats who decamped last month returned to Austin, Texas on Saturday, 7th of August. And one of them said enough of his colleagues may also begin trickling back to secure a quorum next days. Notably, Republicans did not invoke a procedural move that would give Phelan the authority to sign arrest warrants for missing lawmakers, as they did when the Democrats left town. Democratic State Representative Eddie Lucio III said those who might return were feeling the pull of personal and professional demands. Eddie Lucio III said, I was encouraged that the baton would be carried by my Washington colleagues at the federal level, that there would be sweeping reform nationwide. Republican Jim Murphy, chairman of the House Republican Caucus, also believed that more Democrats would come back in the coming days. He said, people are talking to their friends and we think we're going to see quite a few more. It was not just Democrats who were absent on Saturday, 7th of August. Six Republicans were also out, including one who recently tested positive for COVID-19. Heading into the weekend, Democratic leaders had not committed to sitting out the entire 30-day session, leaving open the possibility that enough could return at some point to end the standoff. Republicans want to advance an overhaul of election laws in Texas under legislation that largely remains the same despite the months of walkouts and protests by Democratic lawmakers. Under the bill that Republicans were on the brink of passing in May, Texas would ban 24-hour polling locations, drive-through voting, and give partisan poll watchers more access. But that effort was foiled by Democrats abruptly leaving the Capitol in a late-night walkout. Democrats made a bigger gambit by decamping to Washington on chartered jets to run out the clock on the GOP's second try. Democrats had hoped to exert pressure on President Joe Biden and Congress to pass federal voting rights legislation, but a Senate Republican filibuster continues to block such a measure. Democrat Jasmine Crockett, one of the state representatives remaining in Washington, said she would be disappointed if enough of her colleagues returned to give Republicans a quorum over the next days. She said their group is not naive and knows that they don't have the votes to permanently hold off passage of a bill in Texas, but are still hoping for movement in Congress. President Joe Biden never met with the Texas Democrats in Washington. The group was quickly forced to change some plans after several of their members tested positive for COVID-19. Reports that two Democrats snuck away to Europe also led to bad headlines and invited mockery from Republicans back home. There has been a recent sharp surge in COVID infections in Texas, where the number of people hospitalized with the virus stands at more than 8,500, the highest number since February. But Texas Governor Greg Abbott is adamant that Texas will not bring back pandemic restrictions or mask mandates and has prohibited schools from requiring face coverings. Many of the state's 5 million students are scheduled to return to classrooms at the end of this month. Moreover, when a legion of Texans ascended on their state capitol on Saturday, 31st of July, the signs they carried conveyed raw terror about the erosion of their so-called democracy. Slogans included "Protect Voting Rights," "End the Filibuster," and "Say No to Jim Crow." Some had just concluded a days-long 27-mile march from Georgetown to Austin, praying with their feet in a desperate attempt to safeguard access to the vote. For hours, they withstood blistering heat to rally round a casket, a poetic nod to lawmakers in states across the country they say are trying to bury voting rights. The Reverend Dr. William J. Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, cried, "When you look out here today and see the thousands of people and you look at the diversity in this crowd, this is the America they're afraid of." The high-stakes protests mirrored a historic march in 1965 when voting rights advocates risked their lives in Selma, Alabama, before the Voting Rights Act was secured. More than half a century later, a new generation of activists hope to protect and expand on those victories. Former U.S. Representative and presidential hopeful Beto O'Rourke told The Guardian before participating in the march, "When you get out there and you leave the comfort of your home, and in this case you put on your walking shoes and you cover 30 miles in the middle of the Texas summer in central Texas, you're saying something through that sacrifice and through that struggle." Lawmakers introduced more than 400 restrictive voting bills in 49 states during the 2021 legislative cycle, but Texas has emerged as a key battleground state in a voting rights war that will ultimately shape the American electorate. Its Republican leaders remain hell-bent on passing laws that advocates warn will make it even harder to vote in Texas. So far, such efforts have been thwarted by a tidal wave of opposition. Beto O'Rourke said, "There probably are not many states, if any, that have as dark a history of voter suppression, violent voter suppression, as does Texas." He added, "And yet, you know, it may very well be Texas that helps us through this moment." Earlier this year, the Republican-controlled Texas legislature led the U.S. in new proposals that would restrict voter access, advancing provisions to ban 24-hour and drive-through voting, empower partisan poll watchers, and target vote by mail. While Texans, faith leaders, and politicians gave impassioned speeches, volunteers offered to register eligible voters on the crowded Capitol lawn. Yet even they couldn't ignore the culture of doubt and fear that permeates Texas elections. Texas has the most restrictive voting process in the United States. Critics fear further obstacles would disproportionately affect voters with disabilities and people of color. Many believe Republicans touting election integrity to justify policies are politically motivated, inspired by rapid demographic change that threatens them at the polls. Texas Democrats have twice outmaneuvered attempts to pass sweeping voting bills, first by walking off the state House floor in May, then by fleeing to Washington last month. They have been pushed and bolstered by activists, businesses, and regular citizens who have raised funds, written letters, and testified into the night. Yet voting rights champions can only waylay legislation for so long, and although they gathered at the Texas Capitol recently, they were effectively appealing to Washington when federal voting protections have stalled in the U.S. Senate. The Reverend Dr. William J. Barber said, "Mr. President, the time to act is now. Let me tell you something you might not be used to hearing from a preacher, but ain't no need to have power if you're not going to use it for good." Frustration rippled through the crowd, where Texans fed up with their state officials demanded a response from the White House. Tiffany Williams, an Air Force veteran who joined the march, said, "President Joe Biden, I think, can do a lot more. If you're trying to be for the people, actually come down here and listen to us."
In a statement released on Saturday, the Iranian Foreign Ministry commemorated the Iranian diplomats and a journalist who were killed at the Consulate General of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Mazar-e-Sharif, Afghanistan, in August 1998. The Iranian Foreign Ministry condemned the terrorist attack, saying it was against all international laws and treaties. The body also announced that different aspects of the attack are required to be clarified, and this is a definite demand of the government and people of Iran. 23 years ago, the Taliban captured Mazar-e-Sharif. After that, the group admitted that 10 Iranian diplomats and a journalist had been killed during an attack on the Iranian consulate. The Taliban spokesman said the Iranians had been killed by renegade forces who had acted without orders. Furthermore, the ministry reiterated its call on all parties to the war in Afghanistan to end the conflict and seek a solution in the negotiations. That's while the UN Special Envoy for Afghanistan has warned that the country is heading toward a, quote, catastrophe.
In the past weeks, the war in Afghanistan has entered a new, deadlier, and more destructive phase. The Taliban campaign during June and July to capture rural areas has achieved significant territorial gains. From this strengthened position, they have begun to attack the larger cities.
The Taliban militants have stepped up their attacks across Afghanistan since May, seizing large swaths of rural and urban areas, including some key border crossings. They are now focused on capturing provincial capitals. The Taliban has also vowed to ramp up assaults against top government officials. The U.S. B-52 bombers and Spectre gunships have reportedly targeted Taliban positions in northern Afghanistan. While there has been no confirmation of the airstrikes or possible damage by Taliban militants, Afghan Defense Ministry has declared that the airstrikes inflicted significant damage to the militants. The deployment of American bombers and gunships further highlights the degree of dependency of Afghan forces on U.S. military support. Also, the development has further raised questions about the reliability of persistent claims made over the years by the U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan, that they have primarily been engaged in training Afghan government forces to independently safeguard the country's security against various threats. Meanwhile, the airstrikes came as the militants advanced towards key cities. On Friday, the Taliban captured the capitals of two Afghan provinces in a matter of 24 hours, the city of Shebirghan in Jawzjan and the city of Zarangi in Nimruz.
Of course, the Taliban cannot be expected to provide security to the embassies and diplomats of other countries. And as you mentioned, the incident of what happened at the Iranian embassy and the killing of Iranian diplomats was a very tragic event. But what more can we expect from Taliban? If you look at Taliban's history, if you look at Taliban's rule in Afghanistan, it's a rule of destruction, of violence and suppression. And I'm afraid we are again heading back into the situation.
Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah, has fired dozens of rockets at open areas around the Israeli-occupied Sheba farms. In a statement, Hezbollah said it hit open fields near Israeli positions at 11:15 a.m. local time Friday using dozens of 122 caliber rockets. Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television said at least 20 rockets were fired at Israel's military positions. Al-Minar TV said a number of the rockets targeted the Duf military base. A Lebanese security source said the rockets were launched from the area of Al-Arkoub near the Lebanese town of Sheba. Air raid sirens sounded in the Upper Galilee and in the Golan Heights, part of the territory Israel occupied in 1967. Israeli media said residents of settlements in the north of the occupied territories had been asked to stay in homes. The development came after Israeli jets struck what the regime's military claimed were sites where rockets had been launched earlier in the week.
Bombing Syria, bombing Lebanon is a way of their practice, a way of dividing new states and new communities to get legitimization for their sick political Zionist project. They try everything. They try everything to forbid building a civil state because this is their real threat to their ideology. Defending our land should not be alone through weapons and fighting, but with completing this with a political project which should be contradicted to the Sikh ideology of Zionism.
Regional resistance movements, including Palestinian Hamas and Yemeni Ansarullah, hailed their retaliatory attacks as a legitimate right against Israeli aggressions. Lebanon's parliament speaker, Nabih Berri, said in a statement that the attacks on his country reflected the true nature of Israel. He added that the regime only understands the language of, quote, unity and resistance. President Michel Aoun also denounced the Israeli raids as a direct threat to the security and the stability of the region. Hezbollah Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem also said the resistance movement is committed to the principle that any aggression on Lebanon will be met with a proper response, and for this reason, it responded to the aggressive enemy with rockets. He, however, downplayed the possibility that the situation would escalate to a full-blown war.
Fragmentation of this society, or of our societies, is no less dangerous than the threat of the Zionist project. Managing its affairs, maintaining its cohesion in light of what we are experiencing is not separated from fighting the Zionist project, but it is the core of confronting it.
Israel's attacks on Lebanon's south followed the regime's similar airstrikes on Syria in recent months. The regime has recently threatened to take military action against Iran after accusing the Islamic Republic of being involved in a deadly attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman, an allegation that Tehran has denied. The Islamic Republic has called on the United Nations Security Council to confront Israel's adventurism and reject its fabrications. Tehran says Israel is trying to distract the public attention away from the regime's crimes in the region, warning that any miscalculation on the Israeli side will be met with an immediate and crushing response.
Ibrahim Raisi is now officially the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran after his mandate was endorsed by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, at a ceremony in Tehran. Ayatollah Khamenei's decree endorsed the presidential mandate of Raisi. The text was read out at the event by head of the leader's office. The ceremony took place at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in Tehran in full compliance with COVID safety protocols and was attended by the country's senior state and military officials. Raisi said, through their participation in the election, the Iranian people sent a message that they are demanding change, justice, as well as a fight against corruption, poverty, and discrimination. For his part, Ayatollah Khamenei called for a swift formation of the administration and said the country's conditions do not warrant a delay in the process. R-
Raisi is the 8th president of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He won almost 62% of the votes in the June 18th presidential election and will succeed President Hassan Rouhani, who served 2 4 years.